You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Why don't most people design the kind of financial future that they like to have? Well, frankly, it's overwhelming, which is why Dave and Andrew from the Investing for Beginners podcast are here to help. We decode the hard parts of investing and the stock market so that you can reach for your goals and create the financial future you deserve. Give us a listen at the Investing for Beginners podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Most military thinkers in the years leading up to World War II saw the airplane as an afterthought. But a small band of idealistic strategists known as the Bomber Mafia asked, what if precision bombing could cripple the enemy and make war far less lethal? In contrast, the bombing of Tokyo on the deadliest night of the war was the brainchild of General Curtis LeMay, whose brutal pragmatism and scorched-earth tactics in Japan cost thousands of civilian lives, but may have spared even more by averting a planned U.S. invasion. In The Bomber Mafia, best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell asks, was it worth it? And today, I'm happy to welcome Malcolm back to the podcast to discuss the stranger-than-fiction story of a Dutch genius and his homemade computer, a band of brothers in central Alabama, a British psychopath, and pyromaniacal chemists at Harvard to examine one of the greatest moral challenges in modern American history. Plus, Malcolm talks about his heart-wrenching visit to the museum dedicated to victims of the Tokyo firebombings, his revealing dinner with the top brass of the U.S. Air Force, and why he's making a big bet on audiobooks with his latest offering. Coming up with Malcolm Gladwell in just a moment. Gladwell is the author of six New York Times bestsellers, including Talking to Strangers, David and Goliath, Outliers, Blink, and The Tipping Point. Gladwell is co-founder and president of Pushkin Industries, an audiobook and podcast production company behind his latest book, which is out in print and in a wonderful new immersive audiobook. It's called The Bomber Mafia, A Dream, A Temptation, and The Longest Night of the Second World War. Malcolm, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be on the show again.
Well, before we get to the book, I know from the last time we spoke that your preferred writing routine had sort of been disrupted by the pandemic. Have you returned to writing in cafes yet?
I have. The cafes in the little town where I live have reopened, so I can return to my favorite haunts.
Wonderful. I love this new audiobook, by the way. I really enjoyed listening to The Bomber Mafia. You have pioneered the art of the immersive audiobook. The audio versions of your books really, I think, have more in common with your podcast Revisionist History than with your typical audiobook. Take us behind the scenes. What all went into making the audio version of The Bomber Mafia?
Well, you know, I did what I did with Talking to Strangers, which is to do a real good audiobook, you have to start with the intention to do an audiobook. In other words, every interview you do, you've got to collect high quality tape. You know, you can't just put your iPhone down on the table in front of the person you're interviewing. If you're intending to use the voices of the people you're talking to in the finished product, you've got to make sure they sound good. And then it goes from there. You look for this book, we searched through all these archives, Air Force archives, military archives, archives at universities, trying to find tape of the people that we were talking about. It was, you know, if I'm going to spend, as I do in this book, chapters talking about a guy named Curtis LeMay, I want you to hear his voice, because once you hear his voice, you kind of get who he is, you know. And there's numerous examples of that. And then the end of the book describes this incredibly devastating and moving event, the bombing of Tokyo. And, you know, it's important to hear voices of the people who were victimized by that attack. So it's on multiple levels, you let your storytelling be guided by the kind of sound you can find.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just wonderful to listen to. I'm a big fan of the podcast as well. So it really does sound like I'm listening to a long-form version of your podcast, which is wonderful. Now, you've always had better than average sales of your audiobooks. I wonder, can you see a day when audio overtakes print and ebooks?
Already happened in the case of Talking to Strangers. Talking to Strangers has sold more in audiobook form than it has in print form. So I think that day has arrived. That was something we very much had in mind. My expectation was that if you produced a quality audiobook, and as you say, these audiobooks are patterned after my podcast. So it's the same production levels. It's the same team. I mean, I took all the people on my podcast and I just brought them over to work on the book. And my feeling was that if you do that and create something worth listening to, you'll sell more audiobooks than you will print books. And that's exactly what's happened with my last book, Talking to Strangers.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And like you mentioned, talking about podcasts, this new book, The Bomber Mafia, is kind of something that grew out of several episodes of your podcast. It's a fascinating story. And in fact, you actually confess in here to having a fascination with bombs and bombings from childhood to this day. You say you have tons of books about aerial bombings on your shelf. So now I suppose that I've put you on the FBI's radar. What is your interest in bombs and particularly aerial bombings?
Well, I tell the story. My dad is English, was English, and he grew up in Kent in England, which is called Bomb Alley. His was the German warplanes that were flying to bomb London in 1940 flew over his part of Kent. And he would, as a kid, was told by his parents to sleep underneath his bed in case the bombs fell and, you know, would protect, give some kind of measure of protection. And when he was about 5 years old, a German bomb actually landed in my grandparents' backyard. It didn't explode, thankfully. And that was one of the stories I grew up with, was, you know, my father's encounter with a German bomb. You know, it's certain things that kind of stick in your imagination. And I've been fascinated by war and bombs and airplanes ever since.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's always struck me about Britons is just how much the Second World War is a part of their identity and their national character. Even today, when that generation is largely dying off, there are just so many memorials and museums to the war. People still talk about the Blitz and even the entertainment of that era. People like Vera Lynn, who sang all of these wartime love songs. Yeah, she's still very much a fixture of the culture there. Was that the case with your dad and growing up in your family? Was talk of the Blitz and the war over there a common theme that came up in discussion?
Oh, yeah. So my father was born in 1932. So he was, he was a child during the war, and it was permanently imprinted on his consciousness, as it was of that entire generation. Now, I mean, I grew up with my father telling stories from the war and with people of my father's generation. And you're absolutely right. The British, to this day, you walk into a British bookstore, you will see more books on World War II than you will ever see in an American bookstore. So it is, you know, it was this defining event for that country. It was a test of their own, of their courage and resilience, and they passed it. And they've never forgotten that, correctly, never forgotten that. So, yeah, I remember I lived in England as a child. My dad would take us to the beaches, you know, where you could still see the fortifications that were put there in anticipation of a possible German invasion. I mean, it's still very much a part of English life, English culture.
Now, the Bomber Mafia is actually an American story, I guess you would say, and it's something of a forgotten chapter in the 20th century military history and the history of World War II. I wasn't even aware of this story, so how did you first learn about it?
You know, I hate to say that I don't remember. I think it was because, like so many things, I know where I started. I started because I was in Japan and I went to this museum which was commemorated the American firebombing of Tokyo in the spring of 1945. And I just started working backwards from that event, reading and poking around, and discovered this whole kind of story, a story well known, by the way, to military historians, but just not to the rest of us, of this conflict during the Second World War between two schools of thought about how best to use bombers in wartime. And one group was this group called the Bomber Mafia, who were the idealists, who thought that there was a way to use bombers that would reform war, that would claim far fewer civilian casualties. And they pursued this dream through the 1930s, well into the Second World War, before the dream kind of met the test of reality.
And one of the things that you point out in this book is just the vast difference between how airplanes were used in the First World War versus the Second. Of course, I can think of the film footage of the dog fights up in the air in World War I. And then World War II, planes were used very differently. They really had a more centralized role on the battlefield. What was the key factor that revolutionized how we used planes in war?
Well, in World War I, you know, planes are still toys. No military leader in the First World War, senior military leader, took air power seriously. It was a sideshow. And, if you were dropping a bomb in the First World War, you put a bomb inside a... You gave the bomb to the pilot in his little one-seater plane. He flew up, and then he leaned out over the side of the plane and dropped it by hand. That's how you bomb someone in the First World War. Like, so that was imagine, what are the odds? First of all, that bomb's not going to do a lot of damage. And two, you're not going to hit anything, are you? I mean, so what happens really in the late 1930s is that very, very quickly, aviation technology grows up. And you go from planes being these little contraptions made out of canvas and wood to something that really resembles the modern, you know, the B-29 bomber. By the time it comes along in 1943, it looks a lot like what we think planes look like today. So, by the time the Second World War is underway, aviation technology has matured to something that resembles a modern state. And that means all kinds of things. It means that all of a sudden air power matters. It means you can do a lot of damage from the air. It means that you can fly really high for long periods of time. It means you can evade enemy defenses. It means you can carry, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of bombs in a single bombing attack. I mean, I could just go on from there. The kinds of things that happened in the Second World War, where entire cities were obliterated by bombing campaigns, were a function of these innovations in aviation technology that had been made over the previous 10 years.
And one of those inventions that you talk about is the Norton bomb sight. You describe it really as sort of an analog computer. What all went into this device?
Yeah, so if you think about it as a simple physics problem, imagine you're in a car and you're going 30 miles an hour, and I'm asking you to throw a tennis ball out the window into a garbage can. That is a really, really hard physics problem, right? You've got to somehow adjust for the fact that the garbage can is stationary and you're in a moving car. There's going to be, you have to throw the ball with just the right force, just the right speed. I mean, on and on and on. Most of us, I mean, Steph Curry could do that. Most of us could not do that. Now, imagine now dropping a bomb from an airplane that's 20,000 feet in the air, going 300 miles an hour, and there's 100 mile an hour winds, and the temperature is, freezing cold where you drop it, and hot and muggy on the ground, and the target is obscured by clouds, and you're under attack from enemy fighters. I mean, I go on and on and on. Someone's screaming in your ear. Now I'm asking you to drop a bomb with accuracy under those conditions. It's impossible. And that was the thing. Going into the Second World War, there was no expectation that a bomb dropped from an airplane would hit its target. None. There's a famous study in England done of bombing accuracy in the early 1940s, and their conclusion is that most bombs they were dropping were landing within 7 miles of the target. I mean, it's absurd, right? The Americans invent this device called the Norden bombsight, which is an answer to that problem, and they believe they have solved the physics problem by coming up with this insanely complicated 55-pound mechanical device called the Norden bombsight, invented by a crazy eccentric Dutch genius named Carl Norden. And the idea is you could train a bombardier for 6 months in how to manipulate all of the bells and whistles and pulleys and gyroscopes and whatever in this analog computer. And if a bombardier knew what he was doing, you could drop a bomb accurately from 20,000 feet.
And it did take a lot of skill to do that. And they were trained, as you mentioned, at this aerial tactical school in Alabama. The people who founded it kind of became known originally derisively as the Bomber Mafia, but they embraced that name. And eventually, there's sort of this legend associated with the Bomber Mafia and how they realized that precision bombing could really revolutionize how we fight wars. Can you recall that story?
Yeah, so this group... There's a group of men, pilots, in the 30, young men, and they're way off in the middle of nowhere in central Alabama, outside Montgomery, Maxwell Air Force Base. And they are obsessed with the potential of the bomber. The bomber is this brand new idea, a plane designed to fly fast and high and carry enormous payloads and do damage to the enemy. And their idea is that if they can successfully solve the problem of how to drop a bomb accurately, then all of a sudden, they become the most important thing in all of war. All of a sudden, you don't need infantry, you don't need tanks, you don't need warships, you don't need anything except bombers. Because their theory is, look, I can send a bomber that's flying way above, so high in the sky and so fast that no fighter jet can catch it and no anti-aircraft gun can bring it down. And if I can drop my bombs with absolute accuracy, why do I need anyone else? You know, if I want the Germans to surrender, I could just send some bombers into Berlin, take out the Reichstag, take out, you know, the power plants, take out some bridges, and what are they going to do? They're going to have to surrender, right? That's the dream.
Yeah, and the Bomber Mafia was really way ahead of their time and helped to shape modern tactical warfare. But even beyond that, they had these loftier dreams. I mean, is it fair to say that they even believed that precision bombing would make the world a better place, or at least a safer place on some level?
Sure, because they had just come out of the experience of the First World War, where there was this unbelievable bloodshed, carnage on the battlefields of Europe, and they were determined not to repeat that. They thought, there's got to be a better way for nations to fight with each other. Do we really have to kill off an entire generation just to resolve some dispute? So their notion was, look, if we can drop bombs accurately, first of all, we don't need to fight land wars, and nor do we need to destroy entire cities to make a point. You know, to go back to that example I gave you of Berlin, you have two choices. You could reduce Berlin to rubble and kill a couple hundred thousand people as you do, or you can take out their power plants and their military factories and their bridges and maybe kill, I don't know, 200 people as opposed to 200,000 people and have the same result. So that's what they mean when I say they were sort of fired by a moral vision. That was the vision, that we can conduct war that has the same result, but claims a fraction of the lives.
Mm-hmm. And they were sort of controversial in their day. I think several of them said that they would probably have landed in jail if any of the higher-ups of the Pentagon had known what they were doing. At one point, they were doing theoretical experiments to figure out what it would take to basically incapacitate New York City. So, and it's interesting because, you know, what you said a moment ago about kind of where air power factored into our U.S. military strategy. The fact that we didn't even have an Air Force. It was a subgroup of the Army, and air power was, even up to probably the early days of World War I, was still sort of viewed as a novelty among the military brass. They met a lot of resistance to this idea from the U.S. military establishment, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you had to have been not just a pilot and not just a kind of passionate advocate of air power, but also a kind of believer in technology. I mean, the Bomber Mafia take a look at things like the Norden bombsight, and they use it as a kind of jumping off point. They see the potential of it because they're so dedicated to the idea of airplanes as the future of warfare. No one else has that. If you're a tank commander or a military general who came up, you know, went to West Point and fought in World War I, and, you know, and your uncle and your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your father all did this, served in the same way in the Army, you don't have that same set of beliefs, that same passionate attachment to this new technology. You think what war is jeeps and tanks and soldiers marching along the ground with rifles strapped to their backs. So the Bomber Mafia, at one point, moved. They were based in Virginia near the power center of the American military. And they're like, we don't want to be in the mix. We want to be off by ourselves. We want to have the freedom to dream. And they moved to the furthest point on the map culturally they can from Virginia, which is from the Washington, D.C. area, which is southern Alabama.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
I'm Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday.
And I'm Kristen Meinzer, culture critic and co-author of How to Be Fine.
Together, we host Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen.
In each episode, we read letters from real people in real quandaries.
Emily says, "Dear Rafer and Kristen, I'm raising a kid who is, to put it bluntly, weird."
Then we dispense a bit of questionable advice.
I'm so bad at dating.
No!
I'm the worst dater. Oh, God, I'm just horrible at it.
And finally, we prescribe movies and TV shows to help our listeners through whatever ails them.
Like the doppelganger character, this kind of...
She was terrible.
It's part advice show, part watch list, plenty of empathy, and lots of laughs.
Did my wife write this letter in under the name Katie?
Listen to Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen wherever you get your favorite shows.
That's Movie Therapy with Rafer and Kristen.
I travel through time to tell you this. Almost everything that happens in politics today has happened before, has been debated before, maybe in slightly different forms. On My History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast, since 2006, I've been examining the history behind today's politics and adding layers of context to some of today's debates and telling some great stories. I'm Bruce Carlson. Join me at www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com or wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, wherever else you get your podcasts from. Learn how George Washington and FDR supported vaccines in their time. Warren Harding or Ulysses S. Grant took stands on racial justice. John and Abigail Adams and what they had to say about free speech and the press. What Abraham Lincoln had to say on that. What were the conspiracy theories that had to be debated during the debate over the Constitution? Were things more partisan or less partisan in the past? We're balanced on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, so I promise you won't be infuriated even if you don't agree. We take a balanced approach. So listen, www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com.
And it's interesting because they didn't just meet resistance from the U.S. military, but also from the British military leaders in World War II, up to and including Winston Churchill himself. What was Churchill and his team's preferred approach to aerial bombing and the resistance to this idea?
Churchill and the senior British brass thought the Bomber Mafia were nuts. They just thought this whole thing is nonsense. There's no way they can hit what they can hit. There's no way. It's all a dream. What the British thought was, the only way to use air power was to flatten your enemy's cities. You go in, you drop as many bombs as you can. You don't worry about where they're going to land. You just figure if you drop enough of them, they will do such damage and kill so many people that your enemy will surrender. So they have, the Barbara Mafia are all about precision and using the smallest amount of force possible. The British are about the opposite. They're like, who cares about precision? Who cares about, you know, surgical strikes? Who cares about any of that stuff? Just go in there and like open up the bomb bay and just let it all go. And don't worry about where it's landing. Just if you have enough planes and enough bombs, you'll do so much damage to something that your enemy will give up.
All of this begs the question, I wonder how much of the British preference for area bombing or morale bombing, as they called it, might have just been straight up desire to inflict maximum pain and get a little bit of revenge for the Blitz.
You think? Yeah. No, it's totally. In fact, Bomber Harris, who was the head of the British bombing campaign, a guy named Arthur Harris, was quite explicit about that, that he thought that the British ought to bomb German cities to rubble for out of revenge for what the Germans did to British cities in the 1940s. You know, this is a critique that has been made many times to the British bombing campaign. It was not motivated by some kind of sophisticated strategic analysis. They didn't hasten the end of the war with their wholesale attacks on German cities. They probably prolonged the war. They were motivated by an emotional desire to get even.
Well, I want to talk about the two figures who loom very large in this book. One of them is Hayward Hansel, who I guess was sort of the Bomber Mafia true believer. And the other is Curtis LeMay, who some people may be familiar with from your podcasts. And he was featured on several episodes of Revisionist History. In fact, he even confessed to having a mild obsession with LeMay. Can you give me a contrast of these two men?
They are as different as two men can possibly be. Hansel is this visionary intellectual, a lover of Broadway tunes, he wrote poetry. His favorite novel was Don Quixote. He comes from a long line of American Southern military. His great-grandfather, I think, was a Confederate general. And he's a true believer in this dream the Bomber Mafia had of using precision bombing to reform war. And he carries this dream with him to the very end of the war and sacrifices his career for this dream. You know, when he would fly home from bombing missions over Europe, he would sing Broadway tunes to his men over the plane's intercom. It just gives you a flavor of what he was like. LeMay's the opposite. LeMay's like a working-class kid from Columbus, Ohio, who always had a cigar in his mouth, who was the most ruthless, unsentimental, cut and dried, said almost nothing, thought that the only way to wage war was to be as brutal and ferocious as you could possibly be, had no time for the intellectual niceties and dreams of the Bomber Mafia, thought they were, you know, he had a famous phrase he used, swivel-chaired intellectuals. He just was, again, a very identifiably American type, but I feel like you can go down and divide famous American militaries into these two camps. There are these kind of intellectual dreamer, idealistic warriors, and then there are the Pattons, the Shermans, and LeMay's in that latter camp. He's as ruthless as you. He's one of the most brilliant air power tacticians of the Second World War.
Right, the Berlin airlift.
But before that, the tactics that were used by bomber campaigns over Europe were all devised by Curtis LeMay. I mean, if you talk to anyone from that generation, they will tell you he was the airman of his generation. He was like, imagine talking to someone who played in the NBA in the 1990s. They would say, you know, Michael Jordan was what basketball was. If you were a B-29 pilot in 1943 in Europe, Curtis LeMay was your Michael Jordan. People would follow him anywhere. But he and Hansel were just diametrically opposed on how we ought to use these extraordinary bombers that were being produced in those years. And they didn't like each other. And I think we could even be stronger than that. I think that LeMay would have had contempt for Hansel. And they have a kind of showdown. The book is all about a showdown between the two of them at the end of the war in Guam. And it is one of the kind of most morally consequential moments in the war.
Yeah, and they ran into some major setbacks in the bombings over Germany and then later in their attempts to run precision strikes over Japan. At that point, I guess LeMay was still not sold on precision air bombings, but was assigned them and kind of was pursuing some effort to, bomb Japan from India, which is not easy because you have to cross the hump or the Himalayas. Why didn't precision bombing turn the war in the way that Hansel and the bomber mafia envisioned? What were the problems?
Well, there were any number of problems, but fundamentally, if you were using the bomb site on a perfectly clear day under blue skies on a testing ground in the Utah desert, it worked like a charm. The minute you put it in real world conditions where there might be clouds, you have to see the target to hit it with a Norden bomb site. There's no radar. It's in the early 40s. In the real world, there's clouds. You can't see it. You can't hit it. In the real world, there's winds. They discover the Gulf Stream late 1944 over the high in the skies of Japan. The Gulf Stream is a meteorological condition that produces winds at high altitudes in excess of 200 miles an hour. You can't drop a bomb from a plane that's being blown sideways 200 miles an hour, right? It's just impossible. And then when you add to that, you're getting attacked by enemy fighters, people are screaming in your ear. So you're some 22-year-old with a high school education who is asked to manipulate an incredibly complicated analog computer. And I add in 10 different unknown variables, clouds, winds, anti-aircraft fire, enemy jet pilots, people screaming at you, the fact that you're terrified, by the way, right? Bullets are whizzing past you as you're trying to do that. I mean, just go on. And so in the real world, the trying to reproduce the precision of the Norden bomb site as it was used in training sessions was impossible. And so they think they can hit stuff, and they can't hit that stuff.
And yet Hayward Hansel never really gave up on the bomber mafia dream, and he resisted resorting to area bombing right up until he was basically sacked or transferred to some position in the boonies. On one hand, his strategies didn't work very well in practice, and yet he still stuck to his principles and this belief in a better way to wage war. So I wonder, how do we assess him? Is he a failure or is he a hero?
Well, he's Don Quixote. I mean, it's no accident that's his favorite novel, because he is the knight. He is the naive, gallant, idealistic knight who tilts at windmills and takes up impossible causes. He was someone who believed that the moral case for trying to reform war was so strong that you had an obligation to persist even in the face of overwhelming odds. And if you'd asked him in 1944, why do you keep doing this even though it doesn't work, he would have told you it will work eventually. And at that point, it will all be worthwhile. And he's right. It does work eventually, except that the eventually is 1990, not 1944. He's 50 years too early. It would take the invention of GPS and a million other things to bring the bomber mafia's dream to reality. But I think it's important that we recognize him for his courage and heroism, moral courage and heroism, that there's nothing wrong with pursuing a dream of a better world in the face of contrary evidence. I mean, we need more people like that, I think.
And as you already mentioned, Curtis LeMay had no such hesitation about using carpet bombing. To paraphrase Dr. Strangelove, how did LeMay come to love the firebomb?
He came to love the firebomb because if precision bombing doesn't work, then what do you do as a practical solution? The answer is you can't just selectively take out targets that you've identified and think are of high strategic value. You got to take out everything because you can't aim anything. And what was the best way to take out everything in Japan? Well, Japanese cities were made of wood. Houses were very close together, wood and tar paper. They were tinderboxes. So LeMay takes this special new material, incendiary device that had been developed explicitly to burn down Japanese houses. It was called napalm. And he's the first guy to really exploit napalm's potential. Napalm was the greatest incendiary device ever invented. And LeMay says, okay, that solves my problem. I don't need to aim at anything. I'll just drop lots and lots and lots of napalm on Japanese cities. Didn't matter where it lands. It'll just start a fire, and the fire will do all the damage. And that's exactly what he does. He burns down over the course of the spring and summer of 1945. He burns down 66 Japanese cities. One of the most extraordinary acts of destruction in the history of war.
And as you mentioned earlier, you visited a museum in Tokyo that pays tribute to those who died in the firebombings. It's a funny thing because there are so many memorials to those who were lost in the A-bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Even here in the U.S., we have memorials to those. But strangely, you say that it's not so much the case with the firebombings over Tokyo and other cities in Japan. It's not even in the city center. It's kind of tucked away in this nondescript office building on the outskirts of town. What do you make of that? What does that say about the Japanese and where that event figures into their history?
It says everyone was very anxious to forget about this episode in the war on both sides. Americans don't want to talk about the fact that we burned down 66 Japanese cities in the space of 3 months. And the Japanese would rather not talk about it either. They would like to put it behind them as well. Not everything of consequence in history gets memorialized, you know? And so you can go to Tokyo and you can see grand monuments to everything of importance that happened in that country's history, except for the events of that summer, which just are consigned to what looks like a dentist's office in East Tokyo.
And as you mentioned a moment ago, we now live in an era when Hayward Hansel's vision of precision bombing has come to fruition with technology like the stealth bomber and drones. The footage of the smart bomb dropping down a chimney is one of the most iconic images of Operation Desert Storm. But now that we're able to do the kind of things that he dreamt of, it also opens up a whole other bundle of questions. Even with all the precision in the world, asymmetrical warfare from Vietnam to Iraq and Afghanistan still requires boots on the ground and lives lost. But even more than that, there's the moral question of drone bombings, maybe eventually without a human at the controls. And you say in here that the more precise the bomber, the more you're tempted to use it. I wonder, where do you suppose those issues would fit within Hansel's moral framework?
I think Hansel would have said, on balance, we're better off in a world where we can hit what we want to hit. He would accept the risk that makes waging war more acceptable and say that's a small price to pay for the fact that we can put the days when we leveled entire cities behind us. You know, if you think about it, if there were to be a kind of full-scale conventional war between, I don't know, China and the United States, where both sides were sending bombers over each other's countries, neither side would level entire cities. It's not going to happen anymore. I mean, it's just not the way war is fought. And I think Hansel would say that's what progress looks like.
Well, on a lighter note, or a little bit of a lighter note, you got to have dinner with the Air Force Chief of Staff and hang out with all of his generals, which sounds like a pretty interesting group. What was that experience like? What did you learn from them?
I got to know the previous guy named General Goldfein, and then he was replaced by General Brown midway through writing this book. And I got to know both of them. They're the outgoing and the incoming Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And I found them both incredibly impressive people. I came away with really renewed respect for the American military. I mean, these are people who understand the moral dimensions of what they do, who are steeped in the history of their service, who are, you know, committed to keeping America safe. I mean, I could go on. General Goldfein, just before he left, invited me to dinner at his house. There's a house on Fort Myer, just across the Potomac from the Capitol, which is where the head of the Air Force lives, on a street where all of these top military guys live. And I had dinner at his house and with his wife. And then afterwards, we had drinks in his backyard, and he invited over, you know, the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs and a couple of other senior Air Force guys. And we had a conversation I'll never forget, just a kind of casual conversation about what it means to be in charge of the world's most powerful Air Force. You know, it's just, it was really an amazing moment. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, sounds like an incredible experience. Well, I mentioned at the top that this book is sort of the vanguard of a larger effort by your company, Pushkin Industries. You're really going all in on immersive audiobooks. Before we go, can you tease any of your other audio offerings to come?
Oh, we got a million coming. For example, we have one coming up with Paul Simon, the singer-songwriter, based on... We began with about 40 hours of conversations with him and have combined that with him playing and talking and arguing. And we combined that with historical tape and produced and all kinds of theorizing and interviews with other prominent musicians. And the result is something that's kind of amazing. That should be out. I'm not sure when that's out. It's almost done, though. But we got a big pipeline of stuff coming.
Well, again, this book is called The Bomber Mafia, A Dream, A Temptation, and The Longest Night of the Second World War. Malcolm Gladwell, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben. It's been really fun.
Thanks again to Malcolm Gladwell for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Bomber Mafia, A Dream, A Temptation, and The Longest Night of the Second World War on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And I especially encourage you to listen to it as an audiobook. It's very, very well produced and really immerses you in the story. Follow Malcolm on Twitter at Gladwell. If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at Kickass News Pod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Kickass News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.